Hello. Hi, well, welcome to Radnor Meeting's Eco Justice podcast. And today we are glad that to have to welcome Bruce Burchard to be with us as he talks about some of the important things that have led him in a very active life as a Quaker. Bruce joined the Religious Society of Friends in 1967. In 1974, he and his wife moved to Philadelphia, where he worked for the Philadelphia Yearly Meetings Peace Committee for 10 years. In 1984, he became the American Friends Service Committee's Director of Disarmament Program until 1992, when he became the General Secretary of Friends General Conference, where he stayed for 19 years. Since his retirement in 2011, he had served several Quaker organizations in a volunteer capacity. He was a founding board member of Quaker Voluntary Service, of the Quaker Call to Action, and of Quaker Action Middle Atlantic Region. He has also served Right Sharing of World's Resources and the Philadelphia Yearly Meetings Eco Justice Collaborative. Bruce is an active member of the Central Philadelphia Friends Meeting. So we are very happy to have him here today and ask him of some of his vast and in-depth experience and activity serving many different causes. Bruce, what brought you to Quakerism, and just as importantly, to being an active Quaker in following your spirit-led view of the world?
My parents, especially my father, were very active in the Presbyterian Church in the small town where I grew up. I was born in 1945. I think I joined the church in probably 1957 or something, 58 maybe. My parents were not political activists, but they, and especially my father, were always very clear that there was a difference between right and wrong, and that it was important to follow right action. He actually told me a story about how, when he was in the Navy, one of the places he was posted, that the Black Navy recruits would sit in one section of the dining hall, and all the white guys the other section. And I remember being impressed. He told me sometimes he would go over and sit with the black guys because he felt that was right. So I had that background. When I went off to college in 1963, by then basically the theology didn't make sense to me anymore. But I still had a very strong feeling that I wanted to be part of a religious community in which the big questions and issues were important and were addressed. Midway through my college career, which was Wesleyan University in Connecticut, I discovered a small Quaker meeting on campus. And by the time I was ready to graduate, I joined that meeting, then went off to Chicago and became quite active in 57th Street meeting in Chicago. So that was 1967 when I went to Chicago. And that at that point, the war in into China, Vietnam into China, was really heating up, getting worse and worse. And very quickly, I got involved in the anti-war movement there. And members of meeting were very involved in the anti-war movement. A big part of my work against the war was becoming a draft counselor. Draft counseling was done in the meeting house in Hyde Park, and I would be on duty one evening a week to meet with young men, some from the university, some from the surrounding, mostly Black community, to give them information and advice as they sought to discern or figure out what they were going to do. And that was also very helpful because I had a I had a low draft number, and I knew I went there to do graduate work at the University of Chicago in anthropology. But I knew that I had a deferment for 1 year, but I knew that deferment would end in 1968. And I became clear that there was no way I was going to go into this military. I should note, I never gave any consideration to leaving the country. This is my country. I wasn't going to leave it. So I filed for recognition as a conscientious objector. My draft board back in northwestern rural New Jersey did not see fit to recognizing my claim. And a long period of over 2 years ensued in which they turned me down and the appeal boards turned me down and I made new appeals. At one point, I was sent an induction order. I had to report for induction into the military, and I knew I'd refuse induction. But I also knew, as an active draft counselor, I knew that the courts in Northern California were giving much lighter sentences for that federal crime. And frankly, I didn't want to spend any more time in prison than I needed to. So I talked to my employer, and I got sent out to San Francisco for a couple of months to get my crime so that I would refuse induction there. When I got to San Francisco, I met a guy who was one of the best draft counselors in the country, and he spent a couple hours reviewing my files, and he said, "They've made several mistakes. You need to write to Washington," which I did. So at the last moment, my induction order got postponed. I went through more stuff with the draft board, and then they sent me another induction order. So I'd been back in Chicago. Now I went out to California again. But again, this guy, a really good draft counselor, said, "This is crazy." He said, "We're going to write to General Hershey himself." He was head of Selective Service, which we did. Anyway, this dragged on. And in the end, I was recognized as a conscientious objector and I did alternate service. I think there's something in your eMERGE list of qualities about endurance or
Yes.
persistence or something like that. And yeah, it turned out I'm nothing if not persistent. I was willing to go to prison if I had to, but I was going to keep pushing. And at any rate,
Yes,
that,
if I
yeah.
can say, that was also when I first met the Quakers in the Vietnam era, as I did not want to go. I did not want to kill. I looked back at my life and I had been throughout my first 20 years had been much, very much a pacifist. And luckily, I was not called. And one of the things that's interesting historically is this is where you're starting out. But today in 2026, we are facing that those issues again at the Radnor meeting. We are reconnecting with our conscientious objector training to counsel. We've had a number of young men who have come to us and want to establish themselves as COs.
That's good. That's great. Hats off to Radnor meeting. That's really important. Yeah. So yeah, that was when I first really became my introduction to political activism and where, again, another one of your values is right action. And that was something I learned from my family. And then something that I confirmed with my activism during the Vietnam War. Yeah, that's how I got started.
Yeah, it's interesting. My father-in-law, who is actually very conservative, has said that that era, the Vietnam conflict, was a large mistake on the part of the administration and our Department of Defense in that it really activated a core of people and made them put the line down. They were on one side of the line or the other side of the line, rather than just letting it slide.
Yeah. My father-in-law was a staunch Republican, an old-fashioned Republican, not like they are nowadays, but And yeah, he never felt that the Vietnam War was a mistake. On the other hand, he and his wife, once I met Demi, I met her in 1969, and he always seemed to respect me, and I always appreciated that. We had a good relationship, even though we were pretty far apart politically. He was pretty far apart politically from his daughter, Demi. And Demi and I were together politically, so that became important. Anyway, I want to pick up on something else that happened subsequent to that period, and it had to do with Demi. When I met Demi, she had just come back from a year on a Fulbright teaching fellowship in India. And I was very interested in India, and particularly in the Gandhian tradition and the Gandhian movement. We didn't have much money. I was teaching at a Head Start program on the north side of Chicago as my alternate service, and she was a graduate student. But we saved up a few thousand dollars, and in September of 19, we flew to Europe and then made our way overland to India, overland through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. Took us about a month. Boy, could I tell stories about that, but that's not the purpose of this discussion. But we got to India, and out of our interest in the Gandhian movement, we went to the Gandhi Peace Foundation, and we got addresses for about a dozen different Gandhian-based development projects in very poor areas of India. And we spent a fair amount of time over the next 6. We were in India for 6 months, visiting all 12 of those projects. And we were both so impressed with the work that people were doing there. These were all Indians. We weren't Americans or Europeans, and with a deep commitment to Gandhian nonviolence and to the Gandhian notion of the word for their movement was Sarvodaya. Sarvodaya in Hindi means service to all, and very much a Gandhian value to serve people, in this case, who are very poor. And one of the things, and this relates to, in my mind, another value that you talk about, which is empathy. I came to just directly experience the conditions in which very poor people in many parts of India lived. And but not just to understand it, I also came to deeply respect so many of the people who were living in those conditions and who were carrying on, and not just to feed their families, but coming together in communities to stand up for their rights and to support each other. So, and that's been really important to me ever since. Actually, I can make a connection to my eventual work on environmental, the whole environmental issue. Maybe I'll go ahead and do that now.
Please.
That has become an important part of the activism I've been involved in. And I have in mind, my family, we friends, most of us are really quite comfortable. We live in a country with a very high standard of living, and most of us are pretty highly educated and not suffering the way some people are, and indeed, including people in our own country. But boy, the people who are living in poor areas of India and Africa, where I've also traveled, this is catastrophic for them. In India now, there are parts of India where summertime temperatures get up to around 120 degrees. You cannot, for us, we have air-conditioned offices. Now, there are a lot of people in this country who don't work in air-conditioned offices. On the other hand, it doesn't get up to 120 degrees. But in India and in Kenya, where I've traveled, that happens. And you die eventually if you're working day after day in those kind of temperatures. It's
Yes, I've
catastrophic.
heard that they can work in the morning, in the early hours of the morning, And
I
then
think that's happening. Yep.
as the sun goes down, and that's it. We live in a very sweet spot here in the Delaware Valley area, as far as climate goes, that we see what's happening there, India, Bangladesh, vast areas of Africa, and they are losing their ability, that is the nature provided ability, to raise the crops, to be able to feed their families. And it is the situation is dire, and we have to be motivated through empathy to understand that is going out there. And we sometimes have to look for those news items, because it doesn't make the news here as much as it's going out there.
Another thing that happened when we were, it was really after we got back from India, I learned about this, what was then a tiny Quaker organization called Right Sharing of World Resources, which had been started as a program within the Friends World Committee for Consultation. I put them in touch with a couple of the Ghanaian leaders who we had met in India, who were carrying out this work among very poor people. And this led to right sharing, getting really involved, particularly in the southern part of India, in Tamil Nadu. And this was a really big deal. Eventually, there were other friends who got involved, particularly one woman from a Boulder meeting in Colorado. But through the contacts that we helped sharing make, this really grew. And then eventually, after I retired from French General Conference in 2011, I joined the board of Right Sharing of World Resources, and I made two trips to India, one with my wife, with Demi, and then another with a new director of Right Sharing of World Resources in, it was around 2016 or so. And again, I was just so moved and impressed by sharing's grants in India get funneled through local NGOs in India and then go to women, just to women. And women get small grants that enable them to buy a cow or to get a sewing machine, start a very small business. But this kind of small business typically enables them to double or even triple their family's income and gives them some very important independence from husbands. Not that they were out seeking it. No, many of them wanted some independence, I'll say that. And some of them had lost their husbands, either they walked out on them or they died or whatever. So yeah, the impact of right sharing programs there has been really impressive. When I think about sharing has had as many as maybe 15 or 20 programs going on at any one time. And when I think about the women that were impacted, their children who were impacted, other family members over all these years, there's tens of thousands of people who've been assisted. And that just feels really important.
Yeah, you have a genuine cultural impact with the work that you can do here at a distance over there. It has very positive effect. And when you came back from India, did it
That's
happen
when
you were working with AFSC?
no that's when I came back from India in 19 we were gone 1973 to 74, and when I came back I started working at the Early Meeting Peace Committee. Anyway, maybe I should move on now to some of what I've been doing since my retirement from FGC. I mean, I was really involved in starting Quaker Voluntary Service, working with this remarkable young woman, Christina Repoli, who had been raised as a Quaker in North Carolina and had the idea that Quaker young people should have an opportunity to do service work for communities and so on in this country. She and I and two or three other very wise friends got together and created Quaker Voluntary Service. And then that's when I also joined the board of Right Sharing. But also I was just being drawn into concern for the environment and around climate change and the climate crisis. Again, going back to some of it to my experience in India, but it grew very much out of my spiritual center, really. Just going back to my childhood, I grew up on the edge of a small town, and a block away from me was the brook. It was a pretty small brook. Even at 5 years old, there was no way I was going to drown in it. So my mother was fine. I could go over any time with my friends and play at the brook. And then if I walked half a mile up through some farmers' fields into the woods, there was an old canal up there that was teeming with salamanders and frogs and stuff. And I just spent an awful lot of my childhood outdoors. And as I went deeper spiritually, as a friend from the beginning, the outdoors, the natural world, the animals, the plants, which I learned some things about, just became more and more important to me in terms of my understanding of the spirit. And for years, Demi and I would take off for 2 weeks at the end of every summer, and we'd go up into Canada or northern Maine, and we do these long 10 to 12 day wilderness canoe trips, just the two of us. Oh, those were the days. It was just so moving and so wonderful. So yeah, after my retirement in 2011, I also began was becoming concerned about what was emerging as the climate crisis. And this eventually led me to join the yearly meeting, Eco Justice Collaborative, which you were part of, and we've gotten to know each other there, and
Yes.
many other friends. And then eventually, remember now, I'm a political activist. And so the part that I wanted to do through the Eco Justice Collaborative was to be working on legislation that would benefit the environment, that would slow down climate change. Pennsylvania is not quite dead last, but 47th or something in terms of solar power per capita and stuff like that. Pennsylvania is the, I believe, the third largest responsible, kind of has third place in terms of responsibility for greenhouse gas emissions of all the states in the country.
Not a good record.
Not a good record. And so I just felt drawn to work on this. Unfortunately, the leadership of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting at the time felt that that kind of activism, any kind of work on legislation would endanger their 501c3 nonprofit status, which personally, I think was ridiculous. When I had worked at the early meeting in the what was that? The 70s.
70s, yes. The
The
Peace
I was
Committee.
doing a lot of lobbying and stuff, and it was a tiny part of their budget. But at any rate, be that a
One of the things that the phrase is that I really liked is that a budget is a moral document. That how we save our money, those who we give deference to for paying taxes, is based on our moral values of who benefits. And I think that is one of the things that large producers, large emitters of fossil fuels would like us to think. It's a matter of we shouldn't use plastic straws to drink with, or the minor things that basically we do not have many options as our final consumer, that it, to affect the large issue of climate change, and we have to find a way to affect the political process to be able to make genuine changes to steer the ship away from a catastrophe. And that's where your political activism is very important now.
Absolutely. So eventually, several of us, including you and several other friends, realized that if we wanted to do effective political action, lobbying, that we needed to create a new organization. So that's when we started Quaker Action Middle Atlantic region as a 501c4. As a C4, of course, we contributors can't take a tax deduction for contributions to us. On the other hand, we're all volunteers. Our budgets are like measured in, I guess, a few thousand dollars a year or something. It doesn't matter much, but we now have a way to lobby, and our focus is on legislation and developments in Pennsylvania, especially, and in New Jersey, and to some extent in Delaware and Maryland. And we work particularly on environmental issues and clean energy, but also we've been working on gun violence. And in the last year, we've agreed to also focus on trying to win back our democracy.
Yes, we need to defend our democracy.
And one reason is that the current regime, with that regime, there's just no hope of getting any kind of government support for the very important changes we need to make to save our planet. Although I will say it's becoming clear that the clean energy revolution is underway, and Trump, with all his bluster and cutting out funds, attacking wind farms and stuff, has not been able to stop that transition in our country. It's just that it could be going faster and, yeah, more holistically
Yeah,
if
and
we.
with more certainty because they have the option, in fact, they do, of shutting down free speech. They have the option of obfuscating facts. They've eliminated so much from the public purview about what the science has shown, basically throwing mud all over the issue. They want to declarify everything. In spite of the fact that it seems that the genuine issues are very clear of how we need to move. And so the work that you are doing, the experience that you bring to being able to address our legislatures and how to do it is really important. And Pennsylvania is a key state for that. It's
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
a purple state.
One opportunity that I had was about 5 or 6 years ago. We elected a new member of the Pennsylvania Senate from our area. It had been held by, I believe it had been held by Republicans for quite a while, but we elected a man named John Kane, who became our state senator. And John had a background in union work. In fact, he had a pretty responsible position within the within his union. And at that time, especially, we were wanted to work especially to support the regional greenhouse gas initiative. And he was part of the pipefitters union. And unfortunately, I don't know if it's unfortunate, but solar cells and wind turbines do not need much work from pipe fitters. And so he came into that position as a new Democrat. He'd never held political office before. And I started getting in touch with him, wanting to talk with him about the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And I was helped very much in this by our colleague Liz Robinson, who was extremely knowledgeable. At any rate, over a period of a year and a half or so, we built up a relationship to some extent with John himself, but and with his staff, with a couple of people in his office, and things began opening up some. And a really key thing, this is a really nice story, but when Liz and I would get on the phone with his staff people every 2 or 3 months about some of this. And I think maybe his staff people were sympathetic to where we were, although they had to stand with the man they served. But a question came up about job training, and one of the staff people said, "Where could we go to learn about job training in green energy, solar and stuff?" And Liz said, "Oh, I helped create a program. Like, I can arrange for you to come and visit this school or educational program we have." training young people, almost all people have college degrees, local young people, in the kinds of skills you need to for insulating buildings and for putting in solar arrays and stuff. So a couple of the staff people came and Liz took them around. And they were really impressed, and they went back to John and said, "You really ought to come see this." And so then he came, and I actually wasn't there, but Liz squired him around to see the programs and the kinds of training that was going on. And Liz said he was fascinated. This was stuff he understood. He was a working man. He wanted to know exactly how the technology worked, and he got really enthusiastic and really active. And from that point on, John became a pretty much an environmentalist and a somebody who was he came to understand that the future, that inevitably we're moving toward clean energy, and that, yep, union people, working people, needed to stop resisting it and needed to get involved. And he himself actually has been on a governor's task force or something to look into a lot of this. So, yeah, this is something that came out of that, and that I played a bit of a role in that, and get
That's
satisfaction.
that is a key issue of this political action is up close and it is personal. You have to meet those who would appear in some ways to be not aligned with what our goals might be. However, they have real and genuine goals for their own constituents, and you have to reach out and talk with them. You have to establish a dialogue. You have to have a certain amount of courage to go to places that is not just standing on the sidelines and shaking a fist.
Yeah.
This is, you have to meet the people, understand how deep their need is, and it's not antagonistic to what our needs are, and to find a way through political action to make it happen. And that comes with experience. That is very, very important.
And now, of course, we're faced with this catastrophic administration and a Republican Party that just totally caved into Donald Trump and his program. And yeah, political action is more important than ever. If we're going to, it's not just save our democracy as we knew it, is really parts of it are just totally destroyed. So we need to rebuild it. I think from what I've been seeing in the last couple months, and of course, with the this terrible war with Iran, Trump and the Republicans have become very unpopular. And but we need to be serious about how we resist this. Certainly the midterm elections will be important, although we have to be realistic. They are going to pull out all the stops to rig that election, to prevent a lot of people from voting. And yeah, God knows what they're going to do. Yeah, it's not just working on legislation now. It's getting smart about how we increase the resistance from large masses of the public. And what we saw to some extent with ICE in Los Angeles and Chicago, but especially in Minneapolis, they taught us how to do that. And they taught us how to do that in sub-zero temperatures. They were amazing. We need to build upon that. We need to look at effective ways to protect the integrity of these elections. We need to be building strong communities, building connections with other groups that are being heavily impacted. I think we as friends, I believe we're called to take a leading role. We're a tiny portion of the population, but within faith communities, we have a certain reputation and a certain, which gives us a certain opportunity. And we should be, I believe, reaching out to our sisters and brothers in other faith communities and finding ways to develop more power to turn this whole thing around and then to really work to build toward the kingdom of God on earth, to use a theological term. We can't just go back to what we had before. In a sense, assuming that we can stop this terrible thing that's going on, we'll have an opportunity to build an even better democracy and a better country. That's what I believe.
I totally agree. You speak my mind entirely. And we should make sure that the Quaker Action Mid-Atlantic region has more tools there for friends to be able to make those connections and to contact their friends in other states to likewise do that and understand that this is, we've got, I don't know exactly how to say it, not sound too prejudicial. I'm just going to call him a clown at this point, at the head of our federal government. But there are many others in there who are profiting tremendously by the kingly actions that he has taken. And not to forget that they are very powerful. They have an enormous amount of money. They hire very smart people. This is at no time should we say, that they have they're not popular, so they're not going to do well. We need to close the door on the power that they have. We need to become empowered by it. We have to realize our own power and to say exactly what we want in these situations and not just something that's not them.
Right.
It's very important. And that's why I'm glad that you started your discussion about where you started out as a young man, that those times for those of us who are younger than you and I at this point to realize that it matters. It matters tremendously how we face, how we act, and we act with conviction that this is it, that we can't, and in fact, it's so much of the underpinnings of our democratic government has been kicked out from under us that we have to demand that it all be back. And not just the elected government, but the administrative state
Right.
that had many elements of it that were there to protect us, that protect our forest, to protect the safety of what we do. And then we need to take it further. And to, in this time of climate change, that what was there at the end of the Biden administration was just the beginning. And it was a slow beginning, too. And then it got kicked away. We need to reestablish that and to be a part of it.
As Quakers, we certainly are. The beginning is my faith and my experience of the spirit, and it has led me into a real concern to right action, to be acting on behalf of the regular people of this world. And it's a real important calling. And yeah, I do believe that we have something important to contribute to that, and I pray that we'll prevail.
And I think I know that we are very grateful for all that you have shared with us today about the fundamental sense of your spirit and how guided by spirit your actions have been guided by spirit, have taken you out into the world and sought to influence friends and those who are of other faith of from the best Quaker values. So, thank you. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
That's fine. I'm happy to end on this point. Yeah.
Oh,
Thank you.
great. Well,
It's been really good to do this with you.
thank you very much, Bruce Burchard. We are grateful that you've been able to spend this time with us here today.
Look forward to seeing the final product. Okay.
Okay, good.
Okay. Take care, Bert.
Okay, thank you.